job covering heads, clerics in ecclesiastical garb looking self-important, Jewish men with kippot pinned on the back of their heads, children underfoot who looked like miniatures of the adults whose hands they held, and of course, tourists from every corner of the world. The scene brought to mind Luke's description of the crowd that gathered in the same city on Pentecost long ago. Save for the fact that the Parthians, Medes, Elamites, residents of Mesopotamia, Judea, Cappadocia, Pontus in Asia, Phrygia and Pamphylia, Egypt and the parts of Libya belonging to Cyrene, and visitors from Rome, Cretans and Arabs, were all Jews. Jews who had been of the diaspora, probably. Jews who had been dispersed once in Babylonian exile and who now either lived in Jerusalem or had traveled to the temple that was destroyed, the second temple, by the time Luke wrote the book of Acts. They had traveled to the temple that day to observe the Feast of Weeks, which marks both the spring barley harvest that falls 50 days after Passover and the giving of the law to Moses. But for the better part of an hour, we walked through the dark and narrow streets of the Souk, with sights and smells that always invite me to imagine how little the Arab part of the old city has changed in 2,000 years. The storekeepers beseeching me, as they have beseeched visitors to Jerusalem for centuries, to come in my shop, take a look, cost nothing to look. This is usually all that I need to hear. For the end of the walk, we entered the Jewish section of the old city near the Zion Gate and passed the traditional upper room. First time I visited the upper rooms with a group of pilgrims from Nassau Presbyterian Church. And a woman, just a character named Louis Spencer, got up into the upper room, and Louis just looked this way and looked that way and said, "Well, which way did the table go?" Traditional upper room. Compared to the bustle of the Arab section, things were as quiet as they must have been when the disciples hid after the resurrection and ascension of Jesus, waiting and praying for the promised gift of the Holy Spirit. Suddenly, writes Luke, into the room came a violent wind and divided tongues as of fire. Whatever it was that happened on that day in Jerusalem, the words we have been given need to tell us that God's Spirit was poured out on the apostles, turning these frightened men into men who had the boldness necessary to proclaim the gospel to a hostile world. And even more astonishing, in my opinion, God's Spirit moved among the gathered pilgrims, giving each the ability to hear and understand the words of the apostles in their own language. In a sense, we are those pilgrims today, you and I, gathered around this text. How is it that we come to hear these words, each in our own language, and to understand the meaning of God's power made manifest in our fought at you, unmistakably aimed at fellow Jews who had gathered for the festival. Men of Judea and all who live in Jerusalem, he begins. You that are Israelites, listen to what I have to say. Fellow Israelites, he continues. Therefore, let the entire house of Israel know, he concludes. Know what? Know that this man handed over to you according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, you crucified and killed by the hands of those outside the law. But God raised him up. This was the word Luke longed for his people to hear. My heart does more than break when I hear these words today. As I said last Sunday, this is the narrative whose murderous use over the last 2,000 years is on our hands. You could say that Peter communicated in the sense of leading his fellow Jews to see as he sees. At the end of the sermon, the crowd was cut to the heart and said, "Brothers, what should we do?" 3,000 Jews were baptized that day, were added, and devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and fellowship, to the breaking of bread and prayer. And that's so parenthetical aside. The apostles being Jews, the guess is that nothing much changed in practice until as late as the 3rd century and beyond. That's why it is sort of an anachronism to call Pentecost the birthday of the church as we know it. According to the newly published Jewish Annotated New Testament, the church on the one side and the study houses of the rabbinic sages that would formulate the Mishnah and the Talmud on the other would take centuries to separate and centuries more to ossify. On this day, Luke's point is that far from rejecting Jesus at the beginning, the Jews were the first to believe and be baptized. For Luke, the miracle of Pentecost was not the birth of the church so much as it was the reconstruction, the reconstitution of Israel. I thought as Ryan was reading Ezekiel, that sense of the bones gathering sinew and flesh, and the breath of life being breathed into his people. So how then, on a Pentecost Sunday fraught with the history of an institution whose hearing of Peter's sermon has made conversion and are adding to our number of the church's mission, rather than the mutual hearing and understanding of God's address, how is it that we receive the gift of the Holy Spirit, which is not something inside of us so much as it is something between us? If we are to be witnesses in the world to God, to the God whose Spirit imparts the gift of understanding, binding disparate human beings together in a particular way of sharing the world, then what is at stake when we seek to hear and speak the words that make it possible for human beings to be open to one another and for one another? The question is not an idle question, but asked in the Holy Land on a bus carrying 44 Presbyterians and Jews from holy site to holy site. Whether Imagining the Jewish rebels looking from the incredible height of Masada at the outline of Roman encampments, preparing their siege below. Security and vulnerability. Barely grasping the radical redefinition of security and vulnerability in the death camps that has yet to enter language for me. Taking into my heart the ancient olive trees in the Garden of Gethsemane where all forsook him and fled. Security and vulnerability. A political rally in Bethlehem calling for the release of Palestinian prisoners that our Palestinian guide would not speak about on the bus. Security and vulnerability. And in Shabbat in the company of six people with six narratives that left many disconsolate, talking on the Golan Heights about the things that make for peace, and seeing Lebanon and Jordan with Egypt and Iran just out of sight, or late night discussions at the kibbutz where hard questions of each other began to be aired, or tears shed by Presbyterians at the end who were comforted by Jews counseling us to let go of our guilt. Security and vulnerability. You each one know those two gifts in the midst of any close, intimate relationship you have been given. Vulnerability, writes theologian Christine Culp, is an enduring feature of creaturely existence. It is not a temporary condition that can be or ought to be overcome. Persons and communities remain vulnerable. They are always susceptible to harm and therefore almost inevitably marked by suffering and wrong, sometimes by unfathomable tragedy and brutality. And yet they are also always susceptible to transformation. Note then, says Culp, that vulnerability does not equate with or necessarily entail powerlessness and weakness. Vulnerability is intrinsic to being creatures who are interdependent with other persons, living things, and the earth. Or to borrow John Calvin's phrase, simus sumus, I think, let us be whatever we are for each other. As through the work of the Spirit, our authentic humanity is brought to pass through authentic belonging, the gift of the Spirit. The deceptive thing about the story before us this morning is the way understanding seems to be given instantaneously. I rather think that the vulnerability leading to interdependence and authentic belonging given by the Spirit also requires the hard human work of building trust. Here's where security comes into play. For just as vulnerability need not entail powerlessness or weakness, so security need not entail defensiveness and suspicion. Calvin's phrase, let us be whatever we are for each other, presumes the security of being who I am so that the other can be who he is, and so that together we may discover ourselves we would not know without one another. Perhaps this was the aftermath of Pentecost. Building trust as the newly baptized devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and fellowship, to the breaking of bread and prayer. The same simple actions that led 44 Presbyterians and Jews to a new understanding of ourselves and of each other in the Holy Land. I am aware, wrote Julian Resnick, our educator and friend, upon his return, I am aware that my narrative is not the only engage in a discussion with Palestinian guests at a Havdalah service in Jerusalem, and not have to deal with their anger over my question about the United Nations' decision to partition mandated Palestine. That I could agree with Irene Overton from First Presbyterian Church in Germantown, a woman filled with a desire to see only peaceful intentions among all people, and not have to breathe deeply and then disagree with her when all I want is to agree with her. I want to be able to live with both security and vulnerability in my own being, in my own narrative, and in my own land. Can I do this? Is this my strength, or will it be my weakness? What does this mean, asked the crowd long ago in Jerusalem. What does this mean? I pray it means that if we are able to be witnesses in the world to the God whose spirit imparts the gift of understanding, binding disparate human beings together in a particular way of sharing